You're talking so sweet, well, you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well, you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well, you needn't. It's over now.
And good afternoon, Richmond. You are listening to The Defenders Live, and today is Monday. The Defenders is brought to you as a production of The Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality. And to learn more, please visit defendersfje.org or defendersfje.blogspot.com. If you want to reach us by email, it's defendersfje@hotmail.com. And of course, you can always give us a call at 804-644-5834. So, good afternoon, Richmond. Today is the day, or a day, when I just talk. We just chat. And my understanding, as I throw a curve at my engineering staff, is that we are confidently capable of doing call-in shows. So starting next week, we will come to you with a program for how we are going to do that with this show. It'll be a very good thing. I think it'll be akin to being able to interview someone from the general public who can give me a call, and we can chat about an issue that is prevalent on your mind and possibly on the minds of Richmonders, or possibly is an international or national issue that we can chat about here on Defenders Live. One of the things we've always said is how important it is to understand the broader context of issues. Sometimes a big issue can be made more comprehensible by referencing it to something local, and sometimes the opposite is true. And we cover a lot of issues from a lot of places. I will talk about Africa. We will talk about the Middle East and Iran. We sometimes talk about Europe. We talk about countries where people actually listen to WRIR, which are pretty far flung. I remember how excited we were in our first year of broadcast back in 2005 to find out that there were people in New Zealand who were actually tuning in. So that was very cool. And I think it's one of the reasons why WRIR continues to have such an appeal in the community. And so we'd like to take advantage of that and be able to talk about many things. For this show, the context is always going to be social justice. It's always going to be wrapped around the idea of critical thinking, about giving you a kernel of a piece of information, a seed, if you will, that we plant. And we hope that you will nurture it by investigating and grow some knowledge and grow some opinion and grow some desire to act based on what you learn. So that's, again, what we'll do today. So today I'm going to sort of chat with you about a couple of things that came top of mind for me. I have been talking to some people, some new friends, about health and what we eat. And I continue to be amazed at the philosophical approaches to food and what food means to us in terms of being healthy people, therefore people who can grow, thrive, and be strong and fit enough to tackle the challenges that we live with on a day-to-day basis. Some of those challenges are intellectual. Some of them are physical, and some of them are comprehensive. And when I think about comprehensive challenges, I think about the challenge of motherhood or parenthood. But we'll start with motherhood because women give birth. And there's just no substituting that. But then when it comes to child rearing, we're talking about a lot of people. And I think that's been my growing realization. Oh, yes, there are some phenomenal women. There are some phenomenal fathers. There are some phenomenal people who individually have managed to raise children who are healthy, strong, and thriving. On the other hand, even those people who do it themselves, who are solo parents or single parents, they also rely on support networks. They rely on the proverbial village, that community of people around you that you count on to help you raising that child. And sometimes we don't even recognize that that's what they're doing. You know, sometimes it's just the friend that you call to vent. Sometimes it's the decent job you may actually have. Sometimes it's the ability to take a walk in the park and see the same faces that remind you that life is normal and good and moving forward. And then, of course, there are those who directly provide you that. And I think some of this is coming from the fact that when I think about Thanksgiving and the fact that we've had to, I feel like every time it comes up, I have to reassess, what does Thanksgiving mean to me? Why am I okay with celebrating it when it has such funky origins for us in the United States? And how important just the notion of gratitude is, but not simply abject gratitude, not blind gratitude, just like there's no need for abject adoration or abject contempt. These are not helpful. It's always going to be better to be well informed. So in the process of all of that kind of mulling of these kinds of issues, one of the people that came top of mind that kind of percolated up was Harriet Tubman. And yes, Harriet Tubman is one of the, 5 to 10 people who is always talked about during Black History Month. It's as though we have, 5 to 10 Black History heroes, and that's who we talk about, and a curriculum responsibility is met in school if you talk about these people, and you're good, and you can move on March 1st to Women's History. And then there's probably the same thing that happens, that there are 5 to 10 women that we're always going to talk about, and we don't move too far beyond that. So I wanted to talk a little bit about Harriet Tubman and how important it turns out she's been for a lot of people in many different ways. So the story for me as an individual is that I grew up the child, one of three daughters of artists. And my mother is a painter, my father is a sculptor. And in the youngest years of my life that I can remember, they were always giving me books. They were always putting books in front of us. Now, they came from great readers, and I think I've talked about that before with my grandmother and her generation, my parents' generation. They were all terrific readers. Books were always sort of magical because they were always around, and every time you opened one up, especially as a kid when you don't know what the words mean, you can read the words, but you don't know what they mean. There are all these images, the images that trigger thoughts and trigger questions and trigger terrors. And in that one, I'm referring specifically to a coffee table book of the work of Salvador Dali, who I just had nightmares because of that book. But on the other hand, there was this beautiful book. It had a yellow cover, and the yellow cover was the entree to the story of Harriet Tubman as written and illustrated by Jacob Lawrence. And what I got with that was this combination of really powerful graphic images along with a story that was told in the most concise, almost haiku-like language, meaning it was really short, it was to the point, but it was poetic and it was rhythmic. And right away, it was something that I would read over and over again. And right away, it was a story of a girl who rose above the abuse that she took and became this phenomenal person. Towards the end of the story, it kind of ends in this sort of nebulous, ambiguous, spiritual way, in that Harriet Tubman, with the people that she was carrying through the process of escape via the Underground Railroad, she makes it to the Promised Land. And I remember that as a child, I never knew if that meant that she died along the way or if they actually escaped. And it took many years later for me to learn more about Harriet Tubman to realize, of course, that she certainly escaped, that not only did she escape with her own life and achieved her own freedom, but that she returned numerous times in order to save and rescue other people. And oftentimes it was based on saving her own family. But in the reading, of course, you learn more and more about that and how tragic it is that at the same time that she was able to go back and save so many people and large numbers of her own family, sisters, brothers, and their children, there was one sister that she could not rescue and whose children were, even I think while she was there trying to secure their escape, her sister had recently died just before she got there, and the two children were sold away and they were never heard of again. So she went on, though, to save another family who was prepared, and the circumstances worked out, and she was able to rescue that family and take them up to Philadelphia, then up to New York. And many times in those years, she had to help people escape onto Canada because of the Fugitive Slave Act. She escaped in 1849, and in 1850, the Fugitive Slave Act was passed. And from that moment on until the end of the Civil War, it was extraordinarily dangerous for runaway slaves to be caught in the North, because they were by law going to be turned over to those who would transport them back to the South and to their owners. So life was extraordinarily volatile in terms of stability, in terms of safety. You really, really had to be someplace where you were out of the reach of the authorities. And Harriet Tubman, in those 10 years from 1850 to 1860, before she became a spy and a worker for the Civil War on the Union side, of course, she went back and brought people back. To fathom the idea that she would consciously, purposefully, during those years of the power of the Fugitive Slave Act, return to the places where it was most likely that she could be recognized and caught, that she would continue to return and bring people back. There is a fortitude in there that few people possess, and a recognition of what she had to do. And then, you know, just medically, you need to think about the fact that she was injured as a child. It was a head injury, and she suffered narcolepsy. So here you have someone who could fall asleep at any moment, at any point along that journey, who nevertheless persisted and determined and absolutely never for the rest of her life gave up working to free her people. That is a phenomenal story, a phenomenal woman, but truly a phenomenal human being. There just aren't many people with that kind of determination and commitment and fortitude and strength and courage in spite of poverty, in spite of poor health, in spite of any number of excuses that each and every one of us gives for not wanting to do the next chore in our daily lives. So it's a story I like to reflect on a lot. And I'll take this moment to let you know that you are listening to The Defenders Live here on WRAR, Richmond's radio for the rest of us. It's LPFM radio, 97.3 on your radio dial and WRIR.org. You can listen to us again on Tuesdays at noon online and catch up on what you may have missed today. Think about what you want to let me know for the next time. Again, you can learn more at defendersfje.org or defendersfje.blogspot.com. Today's show is that contemplative show that I always do before Thanksgiving, because as I said, I'm always trying to figure out what does it mean. And this year, we are going to be attending the Giving Hearts Community Feast at the Convention Center. And that is a lovely Richmond tradition whereby this organization organizes the serving of a fabulous Thanksgiving meal. I think three different times during the day between 11 and 3 p.m. To be sure about that, you can go to the website, which is thegivingheart.org. And check on that schedule. It is free. It is open to the public. It is designed to offer a community meal, a communal meal for anyone in Richmond on that day during those times who doesn't have a family or somebody to be with, who may not be able to afford a feast on a day when we think we should have a feast. And for those who simply want to be with other people rather than always just sort of hunkering down at home. So it's really turned out to be a very lovely and powerful community tradition. And it makes me think of celebrations. We tend to do our public celebrations as a community in festival format. You know, we want to build it around either a cultural theme or music or art or sports. NASCAR, good God, what an enormous and loud communal gathering that is. But we find ways to do that. And those are the community affirming moments. And I want to say that one of the reasons that I think about that was also on the way here, was I thinking about Harriet Tubman. I was also thinking about Occupy Richmond and about the occupation movements. And about the way that it is often described by those who don't understand what's going on or why they're doing it or what purpose it serves, to, you know, aside from the fact that, no, there is not an electoral political agenda, there is not a legislative or lobbying component to this, because unlike the Tea Party, they're not trying to work in that system, because essentially this is an expression of frustration at that system not working. So, you know, you don't keep throwing your good stuff at something that you think is broken. You try to express that frustration and work on other ways. And so it's not a done deal. And it's not a, you know, we want you to change this law and we want, and this is how we want it done. And when we get to this date and this election happens, we voted in and it's a good thing because we've done our job and then we go home. They're really figuring it out as they go along. And part of what's being figured out as they go along is actually simply how to form a community, how to form a society. Spontaneously gathering and then deciding to spend the night and then deciding to spend another night and then deciding that you are going to spend those nights perpetually means that at a certain point you have to develop not only what your protest is about, but also how you are going to construct your society within a society. And we have many members of the Defenders and other people that I've talked to both in New York and D.C. and Oakland, California and Atlanta, Georgia, here in Richmond, talking to people on a daily basis, finding out the ways in which that is a struggle, that is a challenge, and the fundamental principles from which they are seeking to do that. And one thing that does seem to be common across the board that is very positive is that there is a sense of mutual respect. It is sort of grounded in this idea that all people really should be equal, and therefore you work from the position that we respect each other's right to speak, each other's right to have an opinion, each other's right to be present and to get along. How you do that is not always clear, and it's not easy. Because we have all been raised in this system, in this society, and we have a lot of things that we often have to unlearn when we say we are coming together on the basis of a different principle. Or even to a certain extent, there's this idea that they are coming together to sort of return to the principles of the founding fathers. And there was this really powerful statement by a People of Color caucus in Charlottesville's occupation movement that said, you know what? We are not coming together on the basis of the principles of our founding fathers, because our founding fathers, you know, came in and the first thing they did was wipe out the native people's systems and right to live the way they live here on this land. Their statement almost opens saying, we want to recognize first that we are on land that was colonized from the Sapanai people. That is a powerful acknowledgement. You have to go back. People saying, we want to go back to the origins, and you have to go back to the origins. And we have to go through this process of acknowledgement. And the acknowledgement is that we walk around now on streets that have been built by a society that has evolved from a time at which we began by conquering and by wiping people out and taking over their stuff. that's the founding principle. And if we are going to regroup and redefine our society and move ourselves forward, then we have to go back that far and look at the mistakes that have been made, the powerful, critical decisions that were determined to be the right thing to do for whatever the agenda was. And I'm not talking about agendas that are always sort of good but have gone bad, but agendas that were based on asserting power because they could, and asserting power because they wanted more power. Whatever that was, it is very important that we face it in order that we are going to be able to honestly move forward to something better. And I think that's what these occupation movements have been about and why they are finding it such a challenge, but also so rewarding to be persistent and determined and dogged and ragged, but achieving this ability to demonstrate to people that it's worth doing and that something good is going to come out of this in the end. And that's why we don't know when it's going to end, and we don't know what the end game is going to be for any one of the manifestations of this occupation movement around the country. Here in Richmond, there was a group of representatives that was elected to go and meet with the mayor. And in that meeting, the discussion centered around their right to free speech as manifested by their right to occupy and encamp in public parks, in public spaces. And the outcome of that meeting was that the mayor agreed that he would consider looking at changing the ordinance so that this would be possible. So that is one piece of that struggle that they brought to the table for the mayor. And part of it is, again, because people have now experienced what it's like to be swept off the street by a mobilized militaristic force of the police. And most of these people had not experienced anything like that before. And that is a true educational process, to understand that the same police that you have been taught to and have maybe many times relied on for your safety in the community is also the force that can be wielded against you. That is a powerful education and a powerful understanding that you get to come to. You get to grow up in a society and understand what its various arms are for. And so that's part of the story for today as well. So I hope that you will take what I have talked about today and you will explore more. You can react to the way that I have presented it, but you can also then take that reaction, and I hope that it drives you to investigate and learn for yourself. Go down and talk to the folks in the occupation movements, wherever you are listening to this show, and think about Harriet Tubman. Think about mothers and the villages that raise our children. Think about your friends and family. And I hope that you will go to your own feast at home or out in the community somewhere. Join somebody else, invite somebody else to your house. And I hope that you will think about these things and celebrate and enjoy and stuff yourself sick, you know, and pass out in front of the TV. And enjoy yourself. We have to have those days of celebration, contemplation, rest, break, all of that good stuff. So I hope that you will do that. There'll be many things coming up, you know, in the weeks to come as we approach the holidays. And so we look forward to sharing more of that with you, including our annual participation and commemoration of Gabriel's Rebellion, which we have done recently, but also Kwanzaa festivals. There's the Kwanzaa Collective program. There's also the Alegba Folklore Society's Kwanzaa program. All of the Christmas and Hanukkah and Muslim end of the year harvest celebrations, winter solstice observations. It's really a lovely time of year. And so I hope that you will stay warm and think of others and keep up the struggle as we move forward. Thanks for tuning in to today's Defenders Live, and I look forward to talking to you next week.
You're talking so sweet, well, you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well, you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well, you needn't. It's over now, it's over now.